How many people have heard of the biographical Bible? There's all kinds of Bibles out there. You've heard of the biographical Bible? No, just comb your hair. Yeah. It's like taking a bid at an auction. No, I didn't mean that. Well, I hadn't heard of it either, but apparently one exists. And according to it, the Bible mentions the names of 3,237 different individuals. Now, I wouldn't have known. You could have said it names 4,000 people, and I'd have said, okay, I'd buy that. You could have said it names 800. 3,237. Now, what's confusing is that only 1,794 of these people have a unique name. You know, John. I mean, you know, how many Johns we have around now today? But you can think of some people that have, you know, that's... Nobody else has their name. Well, that was the same with 1,794 people in the Bible. Nobody else had the same name they did. It's a good thing, too. Those names, some of them were pretty hard to pronounce. You imagine calling them, come on, Mereshala Hashbaz, supper's ready, or whatever. You know, come on, John, much easier. Well, all right, so this means that nearly half the people mentioned in the Bible share the same name with at least one other individual. Speaking of John, there are five. But there are 13 Josephs. We can think of a couple Josephs right off the bat. Here's one that surprised me. 31 Zechariahs. 31. Can you name two or three? No. Yeah. Well, you know what's amazing about all that, though? All these people that are mentioned in the Bible. The amazing thing is these people, no matter whether they're mentioned once or 31 times, they had no idea that the story of their lives, or at least part of their lives, or maybe I should say at least their name, would be mentioned in the pages of a Bible preserved for future generations to read about. Mereshala Hashbaz, or whatever, had no idea that we'd be laughing at his name, however, 3,000 years later. And they just didn't know that. If they did, how different would they have conducted themselves if they knew that they would be studied and read about 2,000 to 6,000 years later? Oops. Would they be proud of their accomplishments, or would they be rather embarrassed and ashamed by how their name is mentioned? Some of them are going to see several chapters written about themselves. As I said, others, it just mentions my name. Look, that's me. That's my name right there. Will their reference be one we've looked to as an example of righteous conduct? Or will the mention of their name and their example be one that we refer to as evil? He did evil in the sight of the Lord. Or something that they're very ashamed about. One of the worst examples that I can think of, or I should say a best example of the worst behavior, might be found in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and in verse 17. We have the name of two individuals listed. We've talked about this before. It's in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 17. Breaking into it, it says, and their message will spread like a cancer. Hymenaeus and Philetus are of this sort, who have strayed concerning the truth, saying, the resurrection's already passed, and they overthrow the faith of some. So Paul had to specifically name two church members publicly, and their names recorded for all time as examples of men who strayed from the truth, who led people astray. They couldn't stop arguing about words, men who were given to intellectual vanity. Hymenaeus and Philetus are of this sort. They had an idea that just wasn't right, and they overthrew the faith of some. So because of their example, because of what they did, their name forever linked to false doctrine, their name, more importantly, forever linked to the shame of overthrowing the faith of other church members. How very sad is that? I never want to be guilty of that. On the other hand, we have men's names recorded for us as examples of absolutely stunning success. The name that comes to my mind, first of all, would be that found in Matthew 11, verse 11. We find quite the compliment here regarding the man named John the Baptist. And it says in this verse, "Assuredly, I say to you." So in other words, there's no doubt about this. "Among those born of women, there has not risen one greater than John the Baptist." What's John the Baptist going to feel like when he sees his name in that context? How humbled would he be? Wow, that's amazing. But these men, Hymenaeus, Philetus, John the Baptist, had no idea that we'd be talking about them today, marveling at the incredible failure or their incredible success. The question we're going to ask today is, how do you know whether or not that might happen to you? What if the story of your life was to be written about some 400, 600 years from now, 200 years from now, 10 years from now, for future generations to read about? The question we're exploring is, the book of Acts complete? Some have speculated such is the case because there is no amen at the conclusion of the book of Acts. Will your story be added there in perhaps a second Acts, chapter 18 and verse 1? That's your title today. Second Acts, chapter 18, verse 1. Will your story be there? Chapter 19? Would a future reader of an updated Bible find inspiration from your life story? Or, on the other hand, would your story be held up as an example of failure, wretched failure? What commentary might God have inspired some future author to write about you? And you know what? You still have time to write the remaining verses of that chapter. It's not even been started yet. Your life has, but the concluding verses in the chapter about your life hasn't been lived yet. Your story is not complete. Now, we've been thinking about the future lately in our prophecy sermons, certainly in our Bible studies as well. So we're going to project ourselves into the future again, open up the pages of the Bible. And this time, let's make the assumption that God the Father has inspired additional chapters of a book of Acts. He's inspired a second Acts, maybe a third Acts. But before we do that, I want to clear up something that you're probably thinking. At least it came to mind when I thought about this sermon, and that was in Revelation chapter 22 and verse 18. And you know what that says. Don't add to the book, right? "I testify to anyone who hears the words of the prophecies of this book. If anyone adds to these things, God will add to him the plagues that are written in the book. And if anyone takes away from the words of the prophecy, God shall take away his part in the book of life, and from the holy city, and from the things that are written in this book." So we get the point here. We as human beings are not going to be writing these chapters. We're not going to add anything to the inspired page of the Word of God. But God can inspire, and God can have it written. Perhaps will add to the pages of the Bible for the benefit of future human beings who are not yet born. Human beings who will live during the world tomorrow. Perhaps more inspired pages to be recorded about the world tomorrow, even for those people who will be resurrected after the world tomorrow has concluded, and who will want to know what life was like during what we call the millennium. Today, we're simply asking a hypothetical question about whether or not future stories will be written, and possibly whether or not our story will be included in that. And so with that in mind, what are some possible scenarios from our congregation that might be written about? What are the events that we're living through here in our Hickory congregation today in regards to world conditions? How is the Hickory congregation dealing with local conditions? How is the Hickory congregation part of church history for the 20th and the 21st century? Now, don't you suppose, we've said this, haven't we, that we believe we're living in the last days. We believe that we are the last generation before the second coming of Jesus Christ. What if we are the last generation on earth before Christ's second coming? Don't you suppose that if we are, that the people of the future would like to read about what life was like in that generation? Because it's just history to them. We're living through it. What was life like for you back in those horrible times of the last days? Because we've read in 2 Timothy 3 what the last days were like. Because we've seen that people would be, of all things, lovers of their own selves. Lovers of money. Well, that doesn't make any sense to us living 500 years from now. Boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents. What a concept. I've never heard of that. What was that like? Unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Wow. For the people living 500 years from now, these descriptive words, I don't get it. It's hard to understand. I'd like to know what that was like. And I'm so thankful that I don't have to live in a world like that. You know, the concept of a man entering a movie theater and, shooting down a dozen innocent women and children, men, women, and children, that's just a concept they can't understand. How can they possibly understand the evil of flying an aircraft into a skyscraper in New York City and instantly snuffing out the lives of 3,000 people? Well, I've never heard of such a thing. How awful that must have been. How the people of the world tomorrow will also read about the evil of something we call the Holocaust. Some of us still have a memory of living through that time. What could it possibly have been like to live in such an evil world? They will say at that time, oh, when I read these stories, now I understand why God has bound Satan the devil and his demons, why they're imprisoned in the abyss and why they can't get to us. I'm so thankful for that. We don't have to endure his evil influences. I can understand now how evil Satan really was and how he was able to influence the world. I find your stories hard to believe. But there they are in the pages of the Bible. What will it be like to meet Noah? Have you thought of that? It's a character I'd like to meet. Noah and his family, meeting them in the world tomorrow. What's something that you might like to ask Noah, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and their wives? Wouldn't we today want to know what their world was like prior to the flood? We don't have a whole lot of information about it, do we? God didn't preserve very much, but we do read this in Genesis chapter 6 about Noah and what life was like pre-flood. And remember, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in our day, before the coming of the Lord, right? So let's look at this comparison. Genesis 6 and verse 5. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. You think there'll be a link there to what we read in 2 Timothy 3? What for men in the last days men shall be? I wonder if men were like that in the days of Noah. The Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth. He was grieved in his heart. And then verse 11, the earth was corrupt before God. The earth was filled with violence. And so God looked upon the earth. Yes, indeed, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. But what was it like every day for Noah, for his sons? There's no mention of his warning message to the people to repent. It just doesn't say, and Noah preached to all the people and he said, there's a flood coming. There's not a whole lot there. All we're told is the people were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, and simply were not aware of what was about to happen until the flood came and destroyed them all. So much information is left out. Why isn't it there? Why can't we read about that today? God has his reasons for only telling us what we need to know. And apparently we didn't need to know. So will other people need to know? Will more of this story and life prior to the flood be written about for the benefit of the people? Oh no, not for the benefit of the people who are living in the world tomorrow. Will there be stories written about for the people who lived 100 years before the flood came, when they're resurrected in the great white throne judgment? How will God teach them? Will there be similarities about what their life was like and what our life was like, those of us who are living in the last days before the great tribulation and the day of the Lord? Will these stories be used to help teach the people of the world tomorrow, to help teach the people of the great white throne judgment period exactly what Satan was like, how he influenced the world, and more importantly, how Satan's way led to, at the time of Noah, great destruction, and how Satan's way at the time of the end of this present age also led to total destruction? Time will tell. So let's come back to 2012, to our world today. What are some of the various issues we face as members of the Church of God? We like to get the context of what life was like in biblical times. Well, who's to say this isn't biblical times someday? Maybe our generation is also considered biblical times someday in the future. What are some of the issues that affect each and every one of us as members of God's church living in 2012? Do doctrinal questions come to mind? Oh, maybe they do. I think so. We've had a long history of needing to prove the doctrines we believe and being told and encouraged time and time again to hold them fast. Hold fast what you've been taught. Doctrinal issues are a major part of the discussion of New Testament church members. Let's go back to Acts. We'll say first Acts, right? Chapter 6. Remember when the Apostle Paul was on trial? What was the great controversy of the time? Well, there were several doctrinal issues. Here's a major one. Acts 6, verse 6. When Paul perceived that one part of the crowd there were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council and said, "Well, men and brethren, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged." Over that issue. That was a major issue at the time. The things about the resurrection. Whether or not there even is one. When it will be. And when he said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and that assembly was divided. So the ruling body that was supposed to be the church body, if you will, equivalent to the church, they were divided. Because half of them, the Sadducees, say, nope, there is no resurrection, there is no angel, there is no spirit. But the Pharisees, the other half, said, yes, there is, there's both. And there arose a loud outcry. It wasn't a small minor issue, a loud outcry. And the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, "Well, this is a good man, Paul. He believes just like we do. There's nothing wrong with him. We find no evil in this man. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let's not fight against God." Wait a minute. Angel or spirit? We don't even believe in them, the Sadducees would say. And verse 10, "Now when there arose a great dissension, the commander," the guy who was in charge of Paul, "fearing," what was he afraid of? He was afraid they were going to pull Paul to pieces. Pull him apart, pulling on him, tearing on him. "And he commanded the soldiers to get back down and take them by force from among the people, take him back to the barracks and hold him there." They were so upset over this issue, they were about to tear the prisoner apart, pulling on him. They were upset. So divided about whether or not there was a resurrection or a spirit world that they were ready to riot and pull Paul apart. Doctrinal issues were upsetting the people at that time. What about Acts 15? The issue of circumcision. Verse 1. And certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren. This is what the church leaders are teaching. Unless you're circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. And that was their doctrine. They absolutely believed that. You've got to be physically circumcised, guys, or no chance of being in God's kingdom. Therefore, when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and dispute with them. What's that saying? That's a way of saying it was tearing the congregation apart. There was no small dispute. That means it was a major dispute. So they determined that Paul and Barnabas and some of the others should go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and the elders, and they're going to finally address this question once and for all. Again, a major doctrinal issue in the church at that time, so much so that they ended up having to have a ministerial conference to decide the matter. And of course it was. That wasn't the only. Now, those were major issues. They had other issues going on in the church back then as well. How different things are today. No, there were issues. There was a question that's discussed in 1 Corinthians 8, we're not going to go there, about whether or not it was okay to eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols. Some said, of course not. I would never eat meat sacrificed to idols. You know, I'm only going to have baker beef. You know, that's all I'm going to have. Some of you got it, but some would say, oh, it's okay, it doesn't make any difference, meat is meat. Eventually, there was more and more controversy and division to more major issues. As time passed, there were issues about the Sabbath, issues about the holy days, issues about the Trinity. The point is that we have a record of church doctrinal issues that's been preserved for us in the pages of the Bible. That was during the first century, the second and third century of the church as well. We see some things about that. By the fourth century, a different church has arrived on the scene. What about the issues of today? Will people in the future read stories about us and our doctrinal issues? What will they be? What will people in the future read about us in regards to the doctrinal issues that we're facing today, and more importantly, about how we resolve them? Certainly we had major doctrinal issues and differences with the church in the mid-1990s. And here we are. That group of individuals ended up rejecting almost every fundamental belief that we cherished and continue to cherish today. And eventually, some became no different than mainstream Christianity. I imagine that story will be shared with some future millennial generations, don't you? It was a significant event in church history. I would imagine that 300 years from now, someone will be able to read about what happened in 1994, 1995 AD. Will your name be recorded in that account? Do you wonder what it might say about you, about how you handled it? Now, you know what? That was a long time ago for us now. It's 2012. It's too late to change that now. We can't change what we did in the past. But what about ongoing doctrinal points today? We're still writing the chapters. Are there any thorny issues for you? Things that are hard for you to be in agreement with? Are you in agreement with the fundamental doctrines of the Church of God? That's a good question. We can ask ourselves that. Are you in agreement with church administration in regards to doctrines that are not considered, quote, fundamental, but they are, let's say, administrative? For example, now I'm going to list some. We know these. There are various beliefs throughout the Church of God community in regards to various issues. And some of these issues, you know, they're conflicts. They're tearing us apart. They're dividing us. Some of these issues are, and I'm going to name a few of them, sacred names, new moons, the counting of Pentecost, third tithe administration, eating out on the Sabbath. Christ must return on Pentecost. No, Christ must return on trumpets. Only one man can be in charge. No, it has to be a council. The work is done. No, the work is not done. So you see what I mean. That was just a handful. Will future generations reading about the Church of God in 2012 read, in August of 2012, there were many disputes and contentions about such issues as ... And will we be part of that? What would be written about us in regards to these conflicting issues? Apparently, there were such issues as that in the church during Paul's time. It's kind of always been there, hasn't it? 1 Corinthians 11 talks about the issue of women having their head covered. It also talks in 1 Corinthians 11 about the conduct of members as they come to the Passover service. We're not going to turn to those pages. You can just note that and read it. But there were administrative differences, maybe perhaps even approaching fundamental doctrine issues there. There were apparently different views on this, but Paul wrote something about it that we need to focus on for 2012 and our issues. Verse 16, Paul wrote about these issues. But if anyone seems to be contentious, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of God. The churches of God should not have the custom of having contentious issues. Paul said, we should not do that. We have very clear scriptures in the Bible that disputing and being contentious about such non-salvational issues is something that simply must be avoided. We're going to read those. I have four of them. I'll just go right through them. First, Philippians 2, verse 14. You're not going to have time to read these. This is just for note-taking. Philippians 2, 14, do all things without complaining and disputing. Now, we can go on and say, well, what's the Greek word mean? Well, all right, do all things without disputing. And underline the word all. 1 Timothy 1 and verse 4. 1 Timothy 1, 4, do not give heed to fables and endless genealogies which cause disputes. Don't do that. Rather, he says, we should give heed to godly edification, which is faith. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 4. He is proud, knowing nothing, but is obsessed with disputes and arguments over words, from which come envy and strife and reviling and evil suspicions. Again, that's someone who is obsessed with disputes and arguments over words. They don't talk about anything else. And it said the origin of that comes from envy, strife, and evil suspicions. And we are told 2 Timothy 2 and verse 23. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 23. Avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. And we don't want to be doing anything that generates strife. So we have clear instruction that such issues are to be not continually argued about. They are to be resolved and put to rest. We are told many, many times that we are to be of one mind. We are to be in agreement. We are to be in harmony, at peace. We are to be speaking the same thing. One particular place that says that, 1 Corinthians 1, chapter 10. We've heard this again before. I'm not saying anything new. Now I plead with you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you speak the same thing. I'm pleading that. I'm pleading that there be no divisions among you, that instead that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind, the same judgment. It goes on to say, for it's been declared to me concerning you, my brethren, by those of Chloe's household, that there in fact are contentions among you. People saying, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, no, I'm of Cephas, no, I'm of Christ. And he asks, is Christ divided, or was Paul crucified for you, or were you baptized in the name of Paul? So he says, you know, you got to put that behind you. He's very emphatic about the behavior of the members of his congregation. He was not going to tolerate that division and bickering among themselves. He said, you know, put it aside. Get over it. You know, let's resolve that. Let's not be arguing and conflicting over these things that just sometimes these things don't matter. In fact, what he did say in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 that we will look at, 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 2. Paul's telling the Corinthian church, I fed you with milk, not with solid food, for you weren't able to receive it. And kind of saying, you know, even now I seem to get the idea that some of you still can't receive it. You're still not able. Because, is he speaking to the entire congregation or some of them? Perhaps just some of them. Congregation, he says, you're still carnal. And that meaning too involved, not in the real spiritual things, but more in the things that just don't matter. For where there's strife and envy and divisions among you, are you not being carnal? Aren't you behaving like mere men? And he says, we've got to get over that, congregation. We can't do that. So do you think that maybe sometimes, oh, you're just making too much of that. Make too much of the fact that there are, yes, today, certain doctrinal divisions and administrative differences in the church. Isn't it okay to have disagreements? As long as we all just get along, I can still believe totally different than you do. Is that okay? Well, Romans 16 tells us to be careful not to cross that line, wherever that line is. And we're going to read, we're going to kind of define the line here. Romans 16, verse 17. Now I urge you, brethren, note those who cause divisions and offenses that are contrary to the doctrine that you've learned. Note them and avoid them. For those who are such, they're not serving the Lord Jesus Christ, but no, rather it's an inward thing. It's a selfishness, their own belly. By smooth words and flattering speech, they deceive the heart of the simple. And we wouldn't want to do that. That kind of reminds us back of that attitude that Hymenaeus and Philetus, you know, all the resurrection is already passed, you know, and overthrew the faith of some. So by whatever issue it might be today, by their smooth words and flattering speech, deceiving the hearts of the simple, will that be written about you later? This tells me that I, then, as a church pastor, have a responsibility before God to note any who would be among us who cause division and offenses to others by speaking things that are contrary to the doctrine which we have learned. My instruction says to tell you to avoid them. And so we're asking, does God mean that or does he not? God writes the names in the Bible of people who failed to do that. He's written about Hymenaeus and Philetus. But they didn't stop there. He gave us other examples. Third John. I think there's just the one chapter. Verse 9. This attitude is quite prevalent in the church, and it is addressed many times. I'm talking about the early New Testament church and Paul addressing it, John and the apostles addressing these things. I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. Therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to name his name, Diotrephes. What he does, how he is prating against us with his malicious words. You see, it's simply not the way people should conduct themselves in the church of God. We've got to get past that. We have to resolve them, and we have to conduct ourselves as the spiritually mature and converted church congregation that I know that we are. Now, we're talking about Hickory today. Wouldn't it be wonderful to see the Hickory congregation described this way? I would love to see this in a future book of Acts. It's recorded about the Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 2. Ephesians 4 and verse 2. It describes a group of people who, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace, because there is one body, one Spirit, as you were called, and one hope of your calling. So I would hope it would be so wonderful when future chapters of the book of Acts are written that it would specifically mention how much unity and peace and harmony there was in the Hickory, North Carolina congregation of the Church of God. What about relationship issues? What about relationship issues? Now, there's a toughie. What are the relationship issues like today, and what were they like in the New Testament church? Do we see any examples written about of that? Well, yes, we do. Philippians chapter 4. It appears the New Testament church had certain problems with relationships, and we see the names recorded of people involved. Here's recorded for all of us these many generations later to see. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 2, he says, I implore, and then the names, Euodia, and I implore Syntyche, to be of the same mind. Oh, not to be divided, but these two ladies, you know, ladies, you need to be of the same mind. I urge you also, true companion, help these women, Euodia and Syntyche, help them who've labored with me in the gospel, with Clement also, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are written in the book of life. So apparently they were not of the same mind about something, these two ladies, Euodia and Syntyche. And perhaps he was asking Timothy to help resolve the issues between them. But notice, Paul said, whatever the issue is between these two, see to it that it gets settled. We're not going to have that. That was very important. He implored them to be of the same mind. Paul talked over and over again about the need for brotherly love among the congregation. I believe that's something we've been talking about as well. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. What a congregation should be like. How Paul admonished the congregations of his day, and it was written about. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 9. But concerning brotherly love, you have no need that I should write to you. Probably some people get tired of that too. Come on, Mr. Kelly, you've talked about that enough. We get the point. And I keep writing about it and talking about it. That's what they said. But concerning brotherly love, you have no need really that I should write to you about it, for you yourselves are taught by God. We know, we've read the book, we read the scriptures, to love one another. And indeed, yes, you do. You do so towards all the brethren who are in Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, that even though, yes, you do it, we urge you to do it more, increase more and more in your brotherly love for one another. Isn't that what we're doing? Isn't that a beautiful thing to be concentrating on? How about substituting the name of our local congregation there? Doesn't it sound even better? Indeed, you do so towards all the brethren who are in Hickory and Asheville and Greensboro and Raleigh, all your other sister congregations, but do it more and more. Relationship problems can be so hard to overcome, but overcome they must be. Nobody is exempt from having relationship issues. We all have them. And nobody is exempt from having it written about for everyone else to see. Now, we've already read about the dispute between Paul and Barnabas over the circumcision question. But look what happened. You'd have thought they'd have got over that at the conference, because there they were, spending time together. So you thought right after the conference, oh, you're my best friend, my buddy. But look at verse 36, Acts 15. Acts 15, verse 36. Wasn't long after the conference. It says some days. I don't know how many days that was. It could be 2 days. It could be 22 days. I don't know. Then after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, now, let's go back and visit our brethren in every city where we preach the word of the Lord. Let's see how everyone's doing. And Barnabas was determined to take with them John Mark. Paul said, no. Paul insisted that they should not take with them the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. John Mark, see, had kind of let Paul down at one time. And he says, I'm sorry, he's not going with me. Barnabas says, I think you should go. Not with me. I think you should go. Not with me. And the contention became so sharp that they parted from one another. Barnabas took Mark and they went to Cyprus. Paul said, that's okay. I'm choosing Silas. Silas, you go with me. How embarrassing. Paul and Barnabas, I think when they read this account, they're going to be a little bit, oops, I didn't mean for that to, it wasn't that bad. Well, it's written about. So sharp. Their contention. Weren't they supposed to be setting the example for us? Well, shame on them. Well, aren't we supposed to be setting an example of godly conduct too? Yeah, shame on us if we don't. Shame on us if we have sharp contention among ourselves. You don't want that written about you in some future chapter of a book of Acts. Instead, what you want is something like what Paul wrote to the Philippians to be written about us. Philippians 1. This is what he wrote about the Philippian church. I wonder if it could be read about the Hickory church. Philippians 1:27. Only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ. Let your conduct be an example of the good news of Jesus Christ. What does that mean? Well, what good news is there? The coming rulership of Jesus Christ, the establishment of His government, our part in it, the role of salvation, everything, being Christ-like. That's what that is. Let your conduct be worthy of that. The Beatitudes on all of those things. That's what we should be like. Let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that, he says, whether I come and see you or whether I'm not there, still I, Paul, might hear of your affairs. And here's what I'm hearing about the congregation, that you stand fast in one spirit with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. And in chapter 2 and verse 2, that scripture that we've read so many times, fulfill my joy, congregation, by being, not at strife, not with contention with one another, but instead, no, fulfill my joy by being like-minded and having that same love, being of one accord, being of one mind, and letting nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, each esteeming others better than themselves. Look, each of you, not only for his own interest, but look out also for the interest of others. Oh, isn't that beautiful? Wouldn't that be great for the church in Hickory to be described that way? Will it be? We've read the scripture so many times, I think we agree this is the standard we need to have. Are we there? Are we there? Would a future generation reading in 2 Acts chapter 18 about our congregation, would they read, well, for the most part, the Hickory congregation was like mine. For the most part, the Hickory congregation was of one accord, but member A and member B continually agitated the congregation by their arrogant attitude of knowing more than everybody else, presenting themselves as the authority on all subjects and causing strife in the church. I wouldn't want that written there. I hope we never read that. I hope this chapter would say that the Hickory congregation was exemplary in being like-minded and having many examples of members who displayed humility, members who continually watched after the needs of other members of the congregation. And you know what? It's not too late to write that chapter, is it? We're still writing it. We can still write it. So what other things you suppose might be written about our congregation in future chapters of the book of Acts? You know what I think? I think we're going to be reading stories just like what we heard in the recent international update video. Certainly those stories are going to be included. In the future, when you want to be inspired and motivated to press on, wouldn't it be helpful to read a chapter in 2 Acts or 3 Acts in a future edition of the Bible and read the story of Bruno and Dario? Remember those from the film? Both in their late 70s, live in a remote village in Peru, walk an hour to catch the bus to church services where they are the first ones to arrive, last ones to leave. Or how about in some future chapter, reading the story of Mary, who lives in, of all places, Mapoko, Zambia. She was blind, you know, wheeled herself in her wheelchair 2 miles to Sabbath services every week. So what inspirational stories like that might come out of the Hickory congregation? We have some, don't we? We have some. You know about some of them. Some of them you probably don't know. God does. God can inspire them to be written. In our local churches today, we have people who face severe trials every day. Some are trials of ongoing illness. And we can't understand why God doesn't heal them, do we? People suffering through these illnesses and problems, they don't understand it either. God does. That's what I wrote about in the blog. God does. He knows. Don't we today see these people being incredible examples of patience and trust and dependence on God? Aren't they amazing examples for us today? We see them. Will God have that written about someday for people to read about their incredible example? Why, that member A in the Hickory congregation, what an example of someone who patiently waited on God. Someone who never doubted God's love for them, never doubted God's mercy and compassion, even though they were going through that trial for so long. God may see to it that they're written about someday to help provide inspiration for some person living through some kind of a difficult trial 400 years from now. What example do we look at today when we think of people who were not like that? When we think of people who just seemed to want to give up on God and said, "Oh, I don't think God's with me anymore. I think God's gone away." If I was going to ask, what example do you think of a people who didn't have any willpower, who simply said, "That's it, I wash my hands of it, I'm going to give up, it's too hard." I think of the ancient Israelites in the desert who kept saying to Moses, "Why did you bring us out here in this wilderness to die? Would that we have stayed in Egypt where we could have eaten the leeks and the garlics and the onions and all that and been better off." I suspect that ancient Israelite Zechariah, whatever his name was, who's going to be reading that story someday, they're going to read that and say, "Oh, I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I said that. I'm so embarrassed. We should have trusted Moses. It was stupid for us to say it would be better to go back into the wilderness. After the Red Sea, and I still doubted." On the other hand, Joshua and Caleb, great examples for us. We read about their examples of faith, how they completely trusted God to fight their battles for them. But we also read in the Old Testament about men who were examples of total failure, like the unnamed man, who's going to read this story someday, who gathered sticks on the Sabbath. Or the story of the rebellion of Korah and those who got swallowed up in the earth. They're going to be, "I shouldn't have done that." We also have a couple of New Testament names that live in disgrace as well. We've already talked about Hymenaeus and Philetus. We're going to read Hymenaeus again in 1 Timothy 1 and verse 20. But this time, along with a guy named Alex. Or I guess that's short for Alexander. I wonder what they called him. Do we know about Alexander in the Bible? And what his job was? 1 Timothy 1, verse 20, breaking into the thought, "Of whom are Hymenaeus and Alexander?" Paul says, "Which I delivered to Satan, that they may learn not to blaspheme." So they were doing something wrong. Well, we have a little bit more mention of it in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 14, a couple pages over. Who is Alexander and what did he do? Alexander, he was a coppersmith. And he says, "He did me much harm." And that's written for us to read about today. "May the Lord repay him according to his works." Ouch. That's pretty hard to read if you're Alexander the coppersmith. Now, we don't have much more information, but wouldn't that be awful to have something like that written about you in the pages of the Bible? I doubt if Alexander thought he was blaspheming. He probably had been a church leader, probably spent a lot of time with Paul. How did he harm Paul? I'm sure Alexander the coppersmith saw, well, I'm right. I'm not doing anything wrong, Paul. Well, who do you think you are? What about Demas? 2 Timothy 4, verse 10. 2 Timothy 4, verse 10. Again, not much written, but it says, Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and he departed for Thessalonica. Now, why would Demas do that? Couldn't he see the picture? Didn't he know what was going on? Didn't he know who Paul was? What an opportunity he had. Wouldn't you like to have had an opportunity to spend a couple years with Paul? Why hadn't Demas captured the vision of God's kingdom? Why did he throw it all away for the glamour of Thessalonica? Will someone write about you that like that someday? Oh, member A, he was a pillar member of the church in Hickory, North Carolina, but he got caught up in the things of the world. He left the church, departed for Greensboro or something. I don't know. Caught up in the glamour. Maybe Raleigh, big city. You know, that verse still never has to be written. We do think that things can be difficult for us, don't we? We have hard times. We have times of frustration. We have times of loneliness. We have times of confusion. Hard to say the word even. Sometimes we get a little disillusioned with what's going on. But does that give us a reason to give up? Are we any different from the New Testament Christians? How can we say, well, that was those people, but I'm different today over here? No, we're the same people. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 8. We read about what they said and the resolve that they had. 2 Corinthians 4 verse 8. Now, we need to take some encouragement from this because, again, these people, they're our brothers and sisters in Christ. They're just like us. They just happen to live a little bit earlier on. And their situations were similar, not the same, but similar. They said, verse 8, 2 Corinthians 4, we are hard pressed on every side, yet not crushed. Some of us are hard pressed, aren't we? Yeah. But what does it say? We're not crushed. We're perplexed. But we're not in despair. Yeah. Can we say some of us are perplexed about our lives today and what may be happening in our lives? Why is this? We're perplexed, but not in despair. We're persecuted, not forsaken. We've been struck down, but we're not destroyed. See, we're stronger. Now, what did Paul say after he talked about these hard times? About how we're crushed, how we're hard-pressed and perplexed and persecuted and struck down. But verse 16, he says to them, don't lose heart. I know it's hard. I know we're perplexed. I know we don't understand. I know, yes, we are persecuted. They're out to kill us. Don't lose heart. For even though our outward man is perishing, and yes, that's a true statement for every single one of us, yet the inward man, where it really counts, is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, whatever it is, it's a light affliction. And it's but for a moment. That affliction is working for us a far more exceeding and an eternal weight of glory. Is that encouraging or not? While we do not look at the things which are seen. So we got to stop that. It says we do not look at the things that are seen. No, look past that. We look at the things which are not seen. You see, God's given us the eyes to see those things. They're invisible to the world, but He's given us eyes to see them. For the things which are seen, that's temporary. But the things which are not seen, that's where it's at. That's eternal. That's the vision we all have to have. That's the confidence and faith that is going to see us through anything. And I mean anything. Tom Clark's one of our pastors. He is the chief pastor, head pastor, senior pastor, I guess is the word, for Ghana, among other places. But on July 26th, he wrote in his travel blog about something. And I want to share that with you. Maybe you've seen it, maybe you didn't. But he wrote about the last day of the African Ministerial Conference and a presentation that was given. And I think it's important for us to hear what was said. So I want to share what he wrote about one of the ministers. Quote, "But for me, far and away, the presentation with the most emotional impact was a somewhat unplanned presentation by Jean-Marie Mendeli. Knowing what he and his family had done 18 years ago, we asked him if he'd be willing to share his story here. He graciously agreed to do that, although, as was evident a time or two during the telling of his story, it wasn't easy for him to relate. Even after this long, the memories are obviously still vivid and the emotions they evoke are strong. I have to admit, Mr. Clark says, to having tears in my own eyes a time or two, as Mr. Mendeli carefully told what had happened. And I've heard this account before. It seemed that many of the men attending were either unfamiliar or only vaguely familiar with the part that the Mendelis played in working to save some Tutsis in 1994 during the ethnic cleansing in Rwanda. He spoke. Joel Meeker translated for us. They did have some pictures on a computer they were able to put up to show us on the screen some of the places and, yes, some of the piles of bones. They hid children up above the ceiling of their house and one in another room. When soldiers found two of them and killed them, they escaped with another, trying to find safety. And in the process of doing that, the Mendeli's own 20-year-old son drowned trying to get water for that family. They lost everything except each other and their faith. It's such a powerful story. During the 45 minutes or so that he spent in the telling of his story, a prophecy from Christ about the end of this age kept echoing over and over in my mind. For then shall be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. As terrible as that time was, we know there's a time coming that will be even worse. Mr. Clark continued with the following observation of this story. Now, when he wrote this, it was like 2 days after I had decided what I was going to be speaking about in the sermon today. The book of Acts, Mr. Clark writes, is one of only a couple of books in the Bible that just seem to end abruptly, leaving one with the impression that God intends to add more chapters to the book at some point, chronicling the events in the lives of his people down through the centuries. There must be many stories showing courage, faith, enduring hardship, and laying down one's life for the sake of our calling and doing what's right. I wouldn't be surprised at all to find Mr. Mendeli and his wife in one of those chapters when it's recorded sometime in the future. So will our story be included in one of those chapters? Just about every one of us knows about someone who has given up the fight. We know someone who has abandoned the faith and fallen back into the ways of this world. We know someone like Demas. Then again, most of us know someone like Mr. Mendeli, a sterling example of courage, of faith, of spiritual integrity. Many of the people like Mr. Mendeli are sitting right here in this room today. Some of them have already had the chapter of their lives completed and are now asleep, waiting for the resurrection and waiting for their crown of glory. The chapter has been written about Aubrey Williams, about Jack McMichael, Gladys Finge, and Rondi Tedder. And you could probably name a few more. That's just since I've been around. That book's written. Will their story inspire to tears someone 500 years from now? It does us, doesn't it? Will their story motivate someone to press on overcome any adversity you might be facing as they face their adversity 700 years from now. Yes, there still will be trials and tests in the world tomorrow. Satan will be bound. Human nature won't be. Character will still have to be built. People aren't going to be robots, and they're going to need inspiration from the pages of the Bible. So as we conclude, think about what might be written about you. There are trials yet to face in your life that you haven't yet handled. There are opportunities for service that have not yet come your way. There are tests of your faith that have yet to become known to you. Perhaps they'll come tomorrow. How will a future book of Acts record what happened to you, a member of the Hickory congregation, God's church, in 2012? Hebrews 11. The faith chapter. Verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises. But hopefully like us, having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, confessed they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly they seek a homeland. And truly if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out of, they would have had opportunity to return. But they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. And therefore God's not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And verse 39, all of these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they, the people in the faith chapter that we've read about, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. So may God grant that we join these courageous men and women of the faith chapter, have perhaps our names written about as examples for others in future chapters. Second Acts, Third Acts, chapter 18, verse 1. More importantly, though, that our names remain written in the book of life.